Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning British music journalist and editor, Alan Jones. And we're talking about his new book, Too Late to Stop Now, More Rock and Roll War Stories. Alan, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thank you for your interest.
Now, is this a sequel to Can't Stand Up for Falling Down?
Yes. Can't Stand Up for Falling Down was published in August 2017, and Too Late to Stop Now came out at the end of May in the UK and in June in America.
And you sort of decided during COVID, this is one of the COVID projects?
Yes. I hadn't really planned for a sequel to the original book.
I'm so glad you did.
But during COVID, when we went into lockdown, for want of anything better to do, really, I returned to some of the stories that I'd worked on and hadn't been able to include in the first book. And I wrote them up. And then I realized I had really a ton more that I hadn't got anywhere near for the first book. So I started writing them up and posting them on Facebook, and it seemed to entertain quite a few people. It was a source of amusement in, you know, rather grim days. Everybody in isolation, nobody could go out. You know, well, you went through it yourself.
Oh yeah.
So I carried on doing it, and then we came out of isolation during the summer. Went back into isolation, so I did a few more. And it attracted some interest from a couple of publishers. So I put all these stories that I wrote on one document and found I'd written over the six-month period something like 95,000 words. So I wasn't too far short of a book, at which point I got in touch with Bloomsbury, who published the original book, and told them that I was working on a second one. And I'd had some publishing interest, and I was just writing to them out of courtesy, really. It said in my original contract that if I had another idea for a book, I had to go to Bloomsbury first. And I fully expected them to say, thanks for letting us know. Good luck with the project. Instead, I got an email back almost immediately saying, don't go to anyone else. We want to do it.
Oh, excellent.
Could you send in a couple of the news stories for us to have a look at, which I did, and the next day they sent me a contract.
Now, many of these pieces were written while you were up at Melody Maker?
Most of the stories, yes. I'd say about three-quarters of the stories in the second book are from Melody Maker. A few towards the end are features, stories on bands that I wrote about a lot in 77, say. I returned to The Clash, to the 101ers, which was Joe Strummer's group,
yep,
before The Clash. And also there's a long interview with Wilco Johnson from Dr. Feelgood. It was going to be the last interview that he ever did because he'd just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Fortunately, some groundbreaking surgery saved his life at the time, and he lived for another 8 or 9 years after the interview. But basically, the stories in both books come from between 1974 and 1984, which was when I was a staff writer on Melody Maker. I became editor in 1984, and obviously circumstances changed. I wasn't traveling so much. But the bulk of both books are from that period on Melody Maker.
Why does the journalism from back then seem so fresh and fun? It seems like a golden age of rock journalism.
It's often described as such. I wonder if people are more impressed and beguiled by the kind of access that writers like myself had to even some of the major stars of the day. You know, you'd go on the road with them and you'd be unchaperoned. There was very rarely anybody from the record company or some high-powered PR getting between you and the person you were writing about. It was just an unfettered time. It was really like the Wild West out there. There weren't the same kind of rules that obtain today. I'm surprised that so much of the journalism from that time stands up, because speaking from personal experience, the deadlines came so fast and furiously. You'd go off for a week, say. I went on the first Clash tour of America, joined up with them in Cleveland, and there was a long overnight drive. We ended up in Washington. And that took, you know, the best part of the week. I met up with them on a Monday, flew back late on the Friday night, and arrived on, you know, back in London on the Saturday. And by Monday morning, I would have to write a 5,000-word cover story.
Whoa!
So, you know, the turnaround was that quick, you know, even on quite major pieces. You know, the Melody Maker was this kind of machine that just ate every word you wrote. You know, you fed it into this kind of furnace just to keep it going. So things were written under, you know, a great deal of pressure. You know, you'd been away, you know, you'd been up three or four nights on end. You'd get back and you just had that blank sheet of paper in front of you that you had to start filling. And as I say, the cover features for Melody Maker in those days were at a minimum 3,000 words, more typically 4,000 to 5,000, sometimes even longer.
But it also seems like the style of writing, like your particular writing, is just so much more fun and interesting.
Well, I think editors in those days, especially my editors at Melody Maker, I can only speak from experience, but I think it pertains to writers like myself on the other titles as well. They kind of entertained and encouraged a much more idiosyncratic approach.
Yeah.
Which you don't really get today. I know on Uncut, the magazine that I edited after I left Melody Maker, I still contributed to it occasionally. And, you know, you're given a very, very strict brief. You know, the editor tells you what they want to know from the artist you're interviewing, what topics should be covered. In the old days, you know, you were just sent out. There were no real instructions. You were just told it was going to be a cover story or that they'd need 2,000 words. You know, you're given a rough word count, but apart from that, you were just unleashed. So, you know, writers like myself just went off and we did what we wanted to do. A lot of us didn't come from strictly journalistic backgrounds. Before I joined Melody Maker, I'd never written a word for anybody, really. I'd written essays of a thesis at art school, so I knew I could put a sentence together that made, you know, roughly some kind of sense. But I had no journalistic training at all. I mean, I knew what the new journalism was. I'd read Tom Wolfe and I'd read Hunter Thompson and Norman Mailer's journalism, some George Plimpton.
Yep.
And that kind of writing really, really appealed to me. So I didn't have any compunction about making myself part of the stories, which somebody with a trained journalist probably wouldn't do, because that was something that wasn't automatically encouraged. But I just found myself throwing myself into the action and making myself part of it, just quite naturally. And it suited the sort of kind of sense of humor I had, I guess.
I mean, there are pieces in this collection that literally made me fall off the chair laughing. I would come to certain passages and I was just, wow. And that brings up a question. I mean, did you burn a lot of bridges writing this column too?
Surprisingly, no.
Like Sting doesn't want your head on a platter?
Not after that piece. I mean, after I wrote the story that's included in Too Late to Stop Now, which was I think the summer of 1979, that they were about to play, the Police were about to play the Reading Festival, headlining that, I think, the first time. And it was just on the cusp of them breaking internationally as one of the biggest bands in the world. And it was decided that it was about time that Melody Maker did a really in-depth story on the Police, but focusing principally on Sting. But after that, I went on. I was asked by Miles Copeland, the band's manager, if I could take time off Melody Maker to go on the Police's Far Eastern tour. And they wanted me to do Australia, New Zealand, I think Japan, Hong Kong. I couldn't take a month off work, but I got 2.5 weeks off work. So I joined them in Bombay, and then we went to Cairo, then Athens, and then Milan. Then I had to go back to London, and somebody else took over the last third of the tour. So I spent 2 weeks with them then after that story, and did another cover story on the Police when I think it was Regatta de Blanc came out. I went to Amsterdam or to Hilversum in Holland where they were recording at a studio. So I got on with him after that. The big blowback from Sting occurred when I reviewed one of his solo albums, Soul Miner, I think it was called, or something dreadful anyway. And by that time, I'd virtually given up on him. He'd become, you know, quite different to when I first knew him in the Police.
Well, could I impose on you to read? We've talked about this over via email.
Okay.
There's a paragraph. I mean, there's a lot, but there's one paragraph in particular. And this is a fascinating piece, by the way. This is a piece not just about Sting, but about Copeland, too.
Yes.
And it's really fascinating, the contrast between the two of them that you bring out in these interviews. Yes, a lot of stuff goes on and a lot of fun goes on in the interviews. But what I also really appreciate about it is you often get to the sort of the inner being. But if I could implore you to read this paragraph about Sting.
Okay, I'll give it a go.
Go.
Give it a go. Okay. Anyway, Sting leads the way into the house, to a smaller room, living room with a color TV in one corner, a stereo in another. There are prints, photographs, and paintings on the wall. It all seems very cozy. Sting settles into a large red velvet armchair, although you get the impression he'd be more comfortable yet on a throne made of the skulls and bones of his enemies, a snarling jaguar at his feet. He certainly has an imperious air about him, someone most at home in a room full of mirrors surrounded by his own reflection. The clear eyes, the broad forehead, those cheekbones, a fictional assassin's cruel smile. It's vaguely the look of one of the minor Caesars, the kind who marries his sister to his favorite horse and races their children at the Colosseum as a warm-up to a headlining act involving the devouring of Christians by lions.
Now that's great rock journalism.
Thank you.
Now, one of the other things that goes on throughout this entire book is there is more drinking that goes on in this book than in any other book that I have read.
Well, some people have told me there's even more drinking in the first book.
I find that hard to believe. By the way, I think, and I'm going to read another section from that Sting and Copeland section. You quote Copeland. I love this quote. Let me put it this way. When he shows up, he's on stage, and when he's not on stage, he doesn't show up.
Yeah.
That's a freaking amazing quote.
Well, Stewart was endlessly quotable. I mean, if it hadn't been for Stewart, I don't think the Police would have stayed together. His faith in the group was, you know, phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
His confidence that they would eventually succeed. Because I first met Sting in 1977. There was a punk festival in Montemarson in the south of France near the Spanish border. And I signed up for it. The headliners were The Clash, The Damned, Dr. Feelgood, and The Jam. So, you know, brilliant lineup. And originally, everybody was meant to fly out, the headliners, the support groups, photographers, and journalists. 2 days before the festival, it was decided that the promoter could only afford to fly out the headliners. So off they went. Everybody else traveled on a clapped-out old bus. It was a two-day drive from London to Montemarsan with an overnight stopover in Paris. So I arrived to catch the coach, and I met an old friend of mine, Andy Summers, the guitarist. And I'd known Andy from a group led by Kevin Coyne, a radical singer-songwriter who signed to Virgin, and we'd become pretty friendly. And more recently, he'd been playing with Kevin Ayers in a really hot little band. So I was surprised to see him. His haircut really short. It was bleach blonde. And he told me he'd just joined the Police. who I hadn't seen at that time, but I'd heard from friends and comments in the music weeklies that they weren't really all that good. And everybody was there was a kind of hostility towards them because of Stewart's prog rock past with Curved Air. Anyway, as we were boarding the coach, Andy introduced me to the bass player in the band, who turned out to be Sting. And he sat next to me on the drive to Dover, and then from Calais to Paris, and then from Paris down to Mont-de-Marsan. And for 2 days, he fretted constantly about the decision he'd made to uproot his family from Newcastle, where he had a steady, well-paid job as a teacher. He had a three-month-old kid, and he'd given it all up to move to London to join the police at Stewart's invitation. And they played some gigs. The gig in Mont-de-Marsan was going to be the first time that Andy Summers actually played with them, so they were a four-piece at that great point. And he just thought he'd made the wrong decision. He couldn't see anything happening for the police. They'd had bad reviews so far, hostile reactions from audiences in clubs around London, and he just didn't know what to do. It was his feeling that he'd made a fundamentally poor decision that had cost him his job, was likely to cost him his marriage, his child. He was just so gloomy. And at Mont-de-Marsan, they weren't very good at all. You would not have thought that this was a group that within a couple of years was going to be one of the biggest bands in the world. I don't think anybody would have foreseen that. Even Nostradamus couldn't have seen it. Nobody could have guessed. And on the way back, his mood was even more despondent. And it got to the point, somewhere between Toulouse and Paris, where I just turned around and said, Sting, you know, if you think it's such a failure, this project, just pack it in. When you get back to London, tell Stewart you're going to leave the group. Tell your wife you're going back to Newcastle. See if you can get your old job back. You could probably be back in the classroom by Christmas. And he said, I'll think about that. It sounds like good advice. The next time I saw him, of course, was the 1979 piece at his house. You know, gold albums on the wall. The police were just on the point of breaking into, you know, this huge commercial property.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning British music journalist and editor Alan Jones. And we're talking about his latest book, Too Late to Stop Now, More Rock and Roll War Stories. There's so many interesting pieces in this book, long ones and short ones. There's a fascinating interview with Peter Gabriel just as he quit Genesis for a solo career. And it was so weird because you kept trying to get him to talk about Genesis. First of all, you hated Genesis. You describe them as they remind me less of a rock band than the bell-bottom equivalent of the school chess team on an outing to an owl sanctuary. That's how you described it. So you were all set to hate his record, and then you listened to it, and you thought you actually liked it.
Yeah, I was really, really surprised. I mean, as you say, I really hated Genesis. You know, prog rock as a whole was a musical thing. It was a musical sinkhole that I just didn't dig it at all. But Gabriel, you know, had left Genesis. He was just about to release the new album. Melody Maker, who, when I joined, was synonymous with prog rock. That's about all they ever covered, except for news stories on the Beatles to reform, which the editor lived in hope for. So if it wasn't, you know, one of the prog rock giants on the cover, it was a spurious story about the Beatles reforming some kind of reunion. So anyway, we got the exclusive interview, and I thought that naturally the interview would be done by Chris Welch, who was our features editor and a longtime champion of prog rock. I mean, to the extent that you thought he'd turn up for work in a chariot, in a cape and a wizard's hat, you know, proceeded into the office, you know, by dry ice and a laser show. He was Mr. Prog Rock. But we were sitting around at the editorial meeting where it was announced that we had Gabriel for the next cover, exclusive interview, big news for Melody Maker in those days, really big news.
Yeah.
But they then announced that Gabriel wanted to make such a a distinction between who he'd been with Genesis and what he was now and the music he was creating post-Genesis, that he didn't want one of Melody Maker's faithful old retainers to go along and do the interview. He wanted somebody who might challenge him a little bit more, who wasn't naturally a fan, so, you know, he could start from a kind of ground zero.
And it was, and it made for fascinating, and it made for a fascinating piece because of that.
Absolutely. I mean, due respect to Gabriel, he could have, you know, got Chris Welch along, who would have, you know, said how brilliant the album was, how brilliant Gabriel was, and it would have been a safe interview. Gabriel wouldn't have been interrogated to any degree about why he'd left Genesis. It was really good on his part, I think, to try to make that distinction. He did want a fresh start, if yep. you like. And because I'd made so many noises about prog rock and how much I hated it, apparently he and his publicist, a guy called Peter Thompson, decided that I should do it. I don't think Melody Maker were entirely thrilled by the prospect of me going to interview Gabriel, because they knew what I thought prog rock generally. But I was given the album, and much to my surprise, I mean, it was free of all the extraneous rubbish that I hated about Genesis. And yes, the lengthy, windy instrumental passages, the virtuosity, the chord changes. It was all too busy, and the kind of mystical aura that a lot of the bands got into. Oh, it was dreadful, absolutely dreadful.
Hey, you're speaking to the converted here.
Oh, okay, yes, you did. I do go on immediately when somebody.
But I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, for people who don't know it, go listen to some. They were the ones that caused punk to happen. Punk happened.
Oh, absolutely.
But I got to talk to you about more of your pieces. There's a long piece, and we can't do this justice. I just want you to tee it up and talk about it. Nick Lowe and the Confederate Air Force. Now, that's a unique piece in this whole book. It takes place in 1981. What was it?
Okay. Nick's father, Drane, was in the RAF as a young man in the Second World War. And he was a squadron commander in bomber command. And so nightly, he would fly along the Ruhr Valley, bombing industrial plants. I mean, a hazardous life at that time. You know, not many pilots survived those bombing raids, but Nick's dad did, Drane. Drane remained in the RAF after the war, so Nick was brought up on a lot of air bases around the world. And always had a great affection for his father and his father's role in the war. When Nick got drunk with Dave Edmunds, at some point he'd always start talking about his dad and his dad's heroics during the war. And he said, what have I done? I mean, I produced Reckless Eric and I produced The Damned. That's about all. But my dad, he flew every night during the war. He saved this country. He'd go on and on and on about it. And Dave would just roll his eyes and say, please, Nick, not again, not again. Anyway, in early 81, I think it was, there was a documentary on BBC television, and it was about this organization called the Confederate Air Force. Based in Harlingen in Texas on the Mexican border. And basically the Confederate Air Force collected, preserved, and maintained at least one of every combat aircraft that had flown in World War II, German, British, American, Japanese. And every year they had an air show where they would recreate the major air battles of the Second World War, starting with the Blitzkrieg, the Battle of Britain, Pearl Harbor, and ending, they had the sister plane to Enola Gay, Phoebe, the two planes that dropped the atomic bomb.
We can't describe the whole story here because people will have to pick up the book.
Anyway,
you decided to go.
Nick decided he wanted to go, mentioned it to a few people, and by the time the flight went off to Texas, there were 20 of us, led by Jake Riviera from Stiff Records and Jake's manager. And it was 3 days of complete madness, really.
I mean, it reads like a movie script. Like, you could make a film out of that one piece alone. Now, we're going to run out of time here, but I just want to show appreciation and give you... There are a lot of great long pieces, but some of the short pieces are just absolutely incredible. They decided to try to bring back Jukebox Jury in 1979.
Yeah.
And you were there for the opening episode, which had the unfortunate Bob Geldof as part of the panel. What a disaster.
Right.
Oh, my God. You want to talk about something that was just... an incredible piece of crap, and Bob was beside himself having to be there.
Yeah, well, Geldof was known as a loudmouth, highly opinionated, very articulate, often very funny. So he, in a way, was a perfect guest for it. But he was mortified when he got there and saw, you know, how he knew how dreadful it was going to be. As he left, he said, "You know, if you write about this and my part in it, just say they made me do this at gunpoint."
Well, it was a disaster. I mean, your description of what goes on in the show is just worth the price of admission alone. There's so many great pieces in this. I like I said, I love the short pieces too. There's a great one of Peter Cook talking about the new Derek and Clive record. And what's nice, I love the way you end this book too, with an essay that was written in 2021, where people are trying to lure you out on this bus for another big night, and you decide to go home on the train. And the book ends, "When the train pulls out of the station, I'm on it. And by the time you read this, I'll nearly be home."
Yeah.
Are you saying your big party days are over?
I mean, that kind of adventure, you know, is consigned to the distant past now. But
okay.
It was very tempting. We're
completely out of time. I hope we've given the audience a taste of what these essays are like. They're fantastic. My guest tonight.
Okay, thank you very much.
My guest tonight is award-winning British music journalist and editor Alan Jones, and we've been talking about his book, "Too Late Now, Too Late to Stop Now: More Rock and Roll War Stories." Alan, it's been a pleasure.
It's great. Thank you very much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.